I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Yasha Munk, professor of practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University. We're discussing his new book, The Identity Trap, from Penguin Random House. Munk is a contributing editor at The Atlantic, a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations, the founder of Persuasion, and the host of the Good Fight podcast. He is an expert in the crisis of liberal democracy and the rise of populism, and has written four books on these topics. Okay, well, first of all, Yasha Munk, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
I'm looking forward to it. It feels like being back in grad school.
That is the exact experience that I like to project here. This was a great book, Yash. I really enjoyed reading it. It's very persuasive analysis and critique of what many call today woke, but you call the identity synthesis. I think it's a great contribution and discussion. I usually start off the podcast by asking about the motivation, your motivation for writing the book. So maybe you could say a little bit about that. I mean, just to, you know, be a little bit more specific about it, since you're someone on the left, what's the motivation for somebody on the left to critique a tendency on the left? Why not go after the many tendencies on the right that we see out there today that are challenges to freedom of speech?
Well, that's a great question. Let me do a little more piece of inside baseball, because I'm not going to get to say that in any other interview about the book, I don't think, which is that one of the fun things about writing the book is that it really drew in a very square way on the different parts of my academic training. So, I was an undergrad at Cambridge and did a lot of history of political thought in the kind of Cambridge school vein at the time. And then I did my PhD more in normative political theory. And since, I've ended up kind of doing a lot of comparative politics. And the different parts of the book really speak to different parts of a training. So I start off with, a very straightforward intellectual history of what I call the identity synthesis. But just trying to understand, hey, where do the ideas that came to be really influential in American universities by about 2010 actually come from? And there isn't a good account of that so far. There's a couple of mostly polemical sort of popular accounts of that. There's not a serious academic account of that. And I try to provide that. And then I ask myself, all right, how do these ideas actually spread in society as a whole? How is it that we go from these ideas being quite influential in universities by about 2010, but very marginal to society as a whole, to having a lot of influence over mainstream institutions by about 2020? And that's a story, which is effectively a story of, broadly speaking, comparative politics and sociology. And then in the third part of the book, I try to critique some of the applications of these ideas to various aspects of contemporary American life and the political life of other liberal democracies beyond the United States. And that's in many ways an exercise in straightforward of normative political theory, trying to ask what kind of regulations should we have, what kind of practices should we have about free speech or about race sensitive public policies, and so on and so forth. And then finally, in the fourth part of the book, I broaden out the argument and say, is this sort of indictment of liberalism that really stands at the center of what I call the identity synthesis successful? Or should we actually defend liberalism against these attacks, which is, again, an exercise in kind of political philosophy? So, but it's not exactly what motivated me in writing the book. But one of the really fun things in writing about the book is being able to use those different parts of my political training. But I know I've evaded your question, so let me answer it straightforwardly. Look, there's two motivations. The first is that I have written, at least two books about the threat of far-right populism, The People versus Democracy and The Great Experiment. I've published hundreds of articles in Slate and The Atlantic and Die Zeit and other places warning about the threat of Donald Trump and other populists around the world. I have a podcast in which I talk about these issues a lot called The Good Fight. And so I've sort of done my tour of duty on that. But I also think that in order to beat those kind of populists over time, we need to look into the mirror a little bit. If for 10 years we've been warning about the dangers of these candidates, and I continue to believe in their danger, we have to ask ourselves, why haven't we been able to win clear political and against those parts of the political spectrum? And I think part of the answer here is that some mistakes that the left is making and some wrongheaded ideas that are deeply unpopular are making it harder to win those clear majorities we need to actually get people like Donald Trump out of the political system. So even though, you know, the identitarian left and the populist right are ideological opponents, they are in some practical ways political allies. One is the yin to the other's yang. The second reason, which is important to me, is that as a good old political theorist, I have normative disagreements about the vision of that part of the left, about the kind of society we want to live in. So I think in you know, other people who are on the left who critique parts of this tradition, engage in what there's a kind of, you know, they're all on the side of the good, on the right, and I broadly agree with them. But, you know, sometimes they're a little radical and they kind of go a little bit too far. I don't think that that's the right way to frame this, because, you know, how can you go too far in fighting against racial oppression? How can you go too far in fighting for those forms of social justice and social progress? Shouldn't we be radicals on that? So I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. I agree with parts of the tradition about the deep injustices that persist in our society, the need to make very significant progress. I have fundamental philosophical disagreements about the diagnosis of what causes the problem and the prescription for how to fix it. And that fundamental disagreement about the kind of society that I think we should live in was one of the motivations for me to write this book, because I think it's an interesting political and philosophical question.
Yeah, that's great. So maybe we could start by saying, if you could say a little bit about what you mean by the identity synthesis, which is your term for what's been called woke, I suppose, which has taken on a kind of ambiguous and clearly pejorative meaning. So identity synthesis is your term, correct? We could say a little bit about what you mean by it and how you came to that particular term.
Yeah, so you know, part of the problem in talking about this topic is that there just isn't a term that is generally accepted as a referent to this political ideology. I think it's clear to anybody who's been following our public discourse for the last 10 years that there is a newish kind of political ideology that first came to be influential in parts of academia and now has a lot of influence on society as a whole. We say the coherence of this, like any other ideology, there's significant disagreements within it, and there's more and less sophisticated versions of it, and so on and so forth. I'm not saying that this is a monolith, but I think we recognize that a lot of the concerns of the left and how they're put today are quite different from what you would have thought of as left wing in 1960, let's say. And so I think we need a term in order to refer to it. Now, woke is interesting because it's a term that actually came from within the movement. It's easy to forget that now. It was something that people on the identitarian left claimed for themselves. You know, we are woke, and that's a good thing. We are awake to, capable of recognizing the injustices in the world. But as you're suggesting, it became very quickly this kind of battle term in which it's, you know, mostly on Fox News, you know, the woke threat to America. And so I've avoided using the term in the book. I've used it two or three times in a specific context or in quotations, but you know, I think if I sort of keep talking about woke, it just ends the conversation before it starts it. And so I wanted to find a term that's sort of honestly boring and neutral enough that we can use it in order to actually just talk about what's going on. And so the identity synthesis, I think, has two virtues. The first is that it has a neutral normative valence in that sense, right? It's not, you can call something the identity synthesis and like it or dislike it. And that facilitates conversation. And the second is that I do think these ideas are a synthesis of different intellectual influences that I trace in part one of the book. And there perhaps finally we get a little bit into the heart of the substance here. You know, the few intellectual histories that have been offered so far of this identitarian turn on the left often describe it as a form of cultural Marxism, right? And there is broadly, you know, Marxists tried to win the fight over our culture and they lost in certain ways. And then they sort of shrewdly and nefariously shifted appearances and put a bunch of cultural concepts at the heart of what used to be economic concepts. And but really, to all intents and purposes, it's the same as Marxism. And so therefore, you know, the way to understand it is cultural Marxism. I disagree with that. And I don't just disagree with that, you know, because of some arguments that people have made, but it's somehow an offensive claim. I think that's overstated. It's just when I started to read the text and do the work, it's just quite clear that this is misunderstanding the tradition. And in my mind, the tradition starts not with Marx, but with somebody who rejected Marx as much as he rejected liberalism, and that's Michel Foucault and the broader set of postmodernist and later post-structuralist thinkers that were tremendously influential in France in the 1960s, 70s, and broadened their interest, their influence across the Atlantic to other parts of the world. And we can sort of double-click, terrible phrase, on any of those, but just broadly speaking, I think that the tradition takes from postmodernism its deep skepticism about standards of absolute truth and its deep interest in political discourse. I think a second ingredient of the ideology is postcolonialism, in particular Edward Said's use of discourse critique to more political ends, which I think has become deeply influential in how much academic work is done today, how much popular criticism is done today, the idea that by critiquing a certain kind of discourse, you can reshape power relations. I think Gayatri Spivak's concept of strategic essentialism is also very influential here. The recognition that people like Foucault might say that on philosophical ground we stabilize wrongheaded, but actually we need to embrace some of them if we are to empower people to resist the oppression that they're experiencing. And so even while on philosophical grounds, you might know that a category like the proletariat or like women or like people of color might be really complicated, in practical terms, we should sort of operate as though they were quite natural. And then the third really big set of influences is critical race theory, including the deep pessimism about the ability of liberal societies to make any progress on social injustices that comes from Derrick Bell, his embrace of a new form of progressive separatism, in which, for example, he ends up effectively arguing that Brown versus Board of Education was a mistake, but perhaps in certain ways we should have created school systems that were separate but truly equal, because the attempts at integration ended up African Americans to such an extreme extent. And then finally, Kimberly Crenshaw's ideas about intersectionality and the way that they were later interpreted by people in her tradition. And so I think the identity synthesis is the set of more popular ideas today that draw on some of these fundamental building blocks, on the skepticism about certain forms of absolute truth, on the embrace of politicized form of discourse analysis, on strategic essentialism and the way in which it gets transmuted into popular culture, on a deep pessimism about the ability of our societies to make progress, on an embrace of a whole swath of race-sensitive public policies which explicitly make how we're treated dependent on the ascriptive group to which we belong, on a skepticism about the ability to communicate with each other, which comes out of one interpretation of intersectionality. And those, to me, are the identity synthesis. Let me say two very brief things about that at the end. The first is that I think there's a sophisticated version of this that I describe in part one of my book that comes from all of these thinkers. We might have some deep and fundamental disagreements, but who are serious scholars worth reading and worth taking seriously. And then there's a popularized or vulgarized form of this that we often encounter on social media and our politics, but is, I think, meaningfully inspired by the things that I'm talking about, but that is often much weaker, but sadly ends up having much more influence on our actual political world. And so I want to distinguish between those levels of criticism. And the second thing I want to say is that one of the really interesting things I found in researching this book is the extent to which some of the founders of what I would call the identity synthesis end up, and this is obviously not unusual in the history of political thought, being quite uncomfortable with where that ideology is taken. And there's wonderful quotes from Edward Said that is quite critical about the way in which a contemporary left starts to think about identity, even in his lifetime. He passed away prematurely nearly two decades ago now. And by Spivak, who is still alive, who laments at one point, for example, the what he calls the identity wallets at American universities. So I want to, you know, give these thinkers who I do critique in certain respects their due as very sophisticated thinkers who should inform our understanding of the world and who themselves became quite critical of what other people then made of their ideas.
So I found your analysis of the history here quite persuasive. I mean, it does really seem to me that Foucault is at the heart of this among the other constellation of thinkers that you're discussing. I get one of my questions about the history here, and maybe this is an unfair question because it asks a little bit in terms of a counterfactual, but I guess the question is why didn't other currents influence the identity synthesis? Like, I'm thinking about a kind of Marxist tradition through figures like Horkheimer and Adorno or Marcuse that emphasize much more the economic rather than the symbolic features of the kind of injustices that we see today. Or on the other hand, and the other big tradition that I was thinking about was, and we tend to forget about this, but some of these issues about multiculturalism, for example, from the 80s and 90s. I mean, Charles Taylor wrote this big essay, The Politics of Recognition. When was that? In the early 90s. In any case, I mean, there's a whole tradition of liberalism in dialogue with multiculturalism that had a very sophisticated kind of account. And a lot of that just seems to have kind of disappeared in a certain way. Maybe I've missed it. But I mean, do you have a theory as to exactly, sort of why some of the economic, resources, intellectual resources have sort of dropped out? Or on the other hand, these sort of more philosophical resources from the multiculturalism movement have dropped out?
That's a really interesting question. I agree with the diagnosis. It's hard to give a definitive answer on the spot, but let me try and offer some tentative thoughts. So the first point that I would make is that quite clearly in the United States and significant, if perhaps slightly lesser extent in Western Europe, what it is to be on the left and what it is to be on the right used to be determined by economic questions. So I always think, if you had been tasked with figuring out who somebody votes for by asking them one policy question 50 years ago, you'd have broadly asked something like, would you rather have a more generous welfare state and higher taxes, or rather have a less generous welfare state and lower taxes? And if you said yes to the first option, then you were broadly speaking on the left. And if you said yes to the second question, then you were broadly speaking on the right. I think today that wouldn't be very powerfully predictive of who you vote for. Perhaps a little bit still, but certainly not in as clear-cut a way as you might think. And that's in part because of a broader sort of social and economic realignment in which there's always been more affluent people who voted for the left, artists and intellectuals, but also perhaps teachers or lawyers and state employees and so on. But really, today, most of the kind of highly educated cultural elite votes firmly on the left in a way that wasn't really true. And we're seeing the first very clear signs of the working class moving to the right in the United States, particularly the white working class, but also increasingly people of color. And very strongly the native working class in Western Europe, for whom far right populist parties are often now the first party, rather than the social democratic parties of the left. So clearly this is going on. I think one of the reasons for this is, especially in intellectual circles, is, you know, the failure of the Soviet Union and the particular model of Marxism that was deeply influential for many decades. I do think that the disenchantment with that has played a role. Focus on the cultural set of questions. There is also some quite interesting research that was just published by Peter Hall and some of his colleagues. Peter Hall, by the way, a wonderful scholar of comparative politics, for those who don't know, has a secret past as a political theorist. He came into graduate school as a political theorist and later switched. So we'll consider him one of ours for purposes of this conversation. But he shows in this empirical analysis that over the last 30 or 40 years, it might feel that a lot of people have shifted to the right on culture, but that's not actually true. By and large, people have moved significantly to the left on cultural issues that you can find on the European Value Survey and the World Value Survey across, you know, 8 big Western democracies, including the United States. And that's true across representative professional positions as well. But some parts of society have moved to the left far faster than to the left a little bit relative to 30 years ago. But professionals and managers, they have moved to the left very, very quickly. And so actually you end up with a broader ideological divide on culture than you had 30 or 40 years ago. 30 or 40 years ago, different segments of the population were closer together on culture than they are now. And perhaps there's something sort of natural where you end up talking about the topics on which society is more polarized, and this greater distance between different parts of a political spectrum is one of the reasons why culture now feels sort of more like it's at the beating heart of politics and the economy. You could also make arguments about economic policy options feeling quite constrained in the 90s and 2000s. You know, there's no alternatives to the policies we have, so how exciting is it to talk about politics? I think that's slightly changed today, and yet the center of gravity of our political debate hasn't quite switched back to the economy. Perhaps that'll still happen, or perhaps that's a sign that wasn't as much of a driving force there as possible. So those are kind of some of the things I'd think through to try and figure this out, but it's obviously somewhat speculative.
Yeah, good. So let's talk about the your critique of the identity synthesis, which you treat mostly in the third part of it, by discussing some core planks of the identity synthesis. I've sort of sketched out five of them. Well, obviously, we won't be able to talk about all of them, but you discuss standpoint theory, cultural appropriation, the concerns about freedom of speech, and identity-sensitive public policy. I thought maybe you could start with standpoint theory, because it's been around for a while, a kind of epistemological theory that sort of prioritizes, that comes from feminism, prioritizes subjects of injustice and oppression in a kind of epistemological access to truth. This is, you know, I think, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, it's been taken up by the identity synthesis in a kind of maybe more radical, but also more simplistic form. Part of my questions with some of these, and it'll come up a few times, is, you know, to what degree are you critical of the way standpoint theory, for example, has been appropriated? And to what degree are you critical of standpoint theory, full stop, right? The philosophical view. Is the problem on your view with standpoint theory as such, or is the problem with, you know, standpoint theory as it comes developed in this political ideology?
Yeah, let me say something to frame that. The way I think about this is that there's big elements of the left's concern with identity that we can learn something from. Certainly, I think we have a much more sophisticated understanding today about the operation of racism in American society and the operation of other forms of identity-based injustice in America and beyond, because of a deep concern about those questions in academia and public life over the last decades, and particularly perhaps the last decade. Now, I think some of those are actually based within the liberal tradition. One of the that people have sort of uncritically accepted this idea that liberals somehow never talked about racism in American history before a more sort of explicitly anti-liberal leftist tradition came along. I think that that is absolutely untrue and a calumny against so many great liberal political theorists, historians, and other thinkers who have, you know, written books about slavery and the Civil War and Jim Crow and all the other kinds of topics. But I also think that some of the thinkers who probably don't consider themselves liberal and who certainly have some disagreements with have allowed us to gain genuine insights about those questions. The problem is that they then use this not to think that liberal societies have to live up to their values or to point out some of the ways in which liberal societies are hypocritical and need to fight against those injustices, but to both blame liberalism for those shortcomings and say that the only real way to the solution is to reject liberalism as a whole. And so when we come to these specific issues, I will say that there are, you know, forms of standpoint theory that I am informed by, but that I have two concerns. One, that the form of standpoint theory that is then used in actual political life, I think, is deeply pernicious and wrongheaded. And secondly, that even the sort of more sophisticated standpoint theorists, not all of them, but many of them, are going to use their critique as part of a building block towards the rejection of liberalism, and that I disagree with them on that. But with that preamble out of the way, let me give you a substantive answer about standpoint theory. So I'm going to talk about standpoint epistemology, broadly speaking, as the more sophisticated academic variant, and standpoint theory as the more narrow, as a more radical sort of popular theory. Now, I think standpoint epistemology has an important insight. Often thought about epistemology, did not think seriously enough about the way in which our perception of a world might be influenced by the experiences we have, which are themselves mediated by the kind of group to which we belong in society. When Descartes was thinking about how we can know anything about who we are in the world and what we can trust, he was thinking in abstract terms, the kinds of experiences that all of us might have, right? Any of us might be deceived by a demon, and how can we make sure that that is not the case? To point out that actually, there's important limitations on our knowledge of the world that have to do with who we are, is, I think, an obvious and intuitive thought. And certainly I'm deeply aware, for example, of the fact that I may be blind to certain forms of injustices because I don't encounter them. As somebody who's white in the United States, I'm the state of the police when I might be if I grew up in a neighborhood in which the police stopped and frisked me just on the basis of my appearance. You know, I don't know what it is like to be afraid when you're on the subway late at night that somebody may sexually harass you. And so certainly, I think parts of the tradition that have raised these concerns are very important. When it comes to what I believe it's Harding calls a sort of folk theory of standpoint epistemology, what I call standpoint theory, I think, however, that we end up with claims that really go beyond that set of insights in a troubling way. Because then you end up, first of all, the idea that you just fundamentally cannot understand somebody who is a member of a different identity group. That's just, you know, our ability to communicate with each other, if I'm white and you Latino, for example, is so impeded that a lot of sort of meaningful political conversation is not possible. And then the sort of political claim that arrives from that political solidarity shouldn't be based on a common sort of analysis or diagnosis of injustice. And it shouldn't aim to move us to embrace some shared principles about what our society should be like and how it's falling short of it. It should be based on a kind of delegation of political responsibility, where I say, look, you know, I'm a white guy and you're a Latina woman, and therefore you're more oppressed than I am. And since I can't truly understand the claims you're making, I should really just defer to your judgment. And whatever political demands you make, I'm going to sort of acquiesce with. I can talk you through the philosophical and political critique of those assumptions, but let me just say for now, but I think it's a really impoverished vision of what solidarity is like. I want to live in a society in which I am capable of communication with the victims of injustice, and we can come to a shared understanding of not the society we want in every detail, but at least the reasons why we want to remedy those injustices. I think the idea that the most we can aim for is for me to say, I can't understand you, but I sort of recognize you're more oppressed than I am, so just tell me what to do and I'll blindly follow. I don't think that is actually an inspiring vision of the future. I think it's actually quite an impoverished one.
Yeah, that's good. I just wanted to follow up by maybe, I guess, but pressing a little bit on the compatibility of liberalism and standpoint epistemology. I guess at the end of the day, how compatible do you think these things are? And I'm speaking about more of the sort of sophisticated version of it rather than the way that it's become developed. Because I'm wondering what's the best way for liberalism to respond to standpoint theory, that is to reject it wholesale or to, appropriate a more reasonable version of it. And I guess one of the things that it strikes me that, liberalism could incorporate standpoint epistemology in certain ways, certainly in everyday public discourse and democratic deliberation. One could find reasonable ways in which you could listen to the views of others who are situated in such a way to provide some kind of insight on a particular issue. But at the same time, liberalism does have a kind of aspiration towards, impartiality, say, in the justice system with standards for evidence and so forth. I wonder if there's a worry about how compatible, say, bringing in something like, witness testimony, say, of particular groups need to be weighted more than others, that there might be a kind of fundamental tension that's at the that's here. What do you think? Or you think that liberalism can incorporate some of those?
I guess in the end, I think that liberalism can incorporate the sensible form of those, but not the ones that I would in fact reject. Let me give you my specific view on how we should think about this topic, and then you can sort of perhaps push me if you think, there's interesting, sensible parts of a tradition that can't accommodate. For me, the question is, all right, what, follows from the recognition that the way you perceive the world and what you know about the world is going to be somewhat influenced by the kind of group of which you're a part? And my answer is that, be despaired our ability to communicate, and it certainly shouldn't be an impoverished understanding of political solidarity that just devolves into me supposedly delegating, which, by the way, is something that most people won't do, that because most people are not going to be thoughtful enough about these issues or sufficiently concerned about justice to decenter their own political preferences and convictions in that kind of way. And even the people who claim to in a diverse society are nearly always going to be insincere, because the white liberal who's more moderate is going to say that Jim Clyburn is the legitimate representative of African Americans, and the white liberal who's more progressive is going to say that Ayanna Pressley is the more legitimate representative of sort of African American political opinion. But whoever actually claims to delegate their views in this kind of way is always going to have to make judgment calls about who actually is the person of a group. It's going to be informed, often not very self-aware way by their actual beliefs about what we should do. So my answer is simple. Look, we need to be deeply aware of the fact that we live in these very diverse societies and that the experiences of our fellow citizens often aren't naturally or easily legible to us. But we should absolutely believe that we can understand the politically salient pieces of their experience by putting in the effort of being in conversation with them. We may not know 100% what it feels like in a subjective sense, but the kind of truths that are derived from that experience, we absolutely should believe can be communicated. And so when somebody tells me something about their experience in the society that at first to me sounds unlikely or implausible, self-aware, I should say, before I dismiss this, let me do the work. Let me make sure that I actually see it from a perspective, that I actually understand how a cop that's always nice and polite to me might suddenly be rude or on edge or prejudiced against somebody else. And then once we have done that work, we should build a form of political solidarity in which sometimes, we agree the reasons why it is that we don't think that your experience of the police should be mediated by the kind of skin color you have, or the freedom of movement you have in society shouldn't depend on the gender you have. And perhaps sometimes we'll have political solidarity for slightly different reasons. I might have secular reasons, and you might have religious reasons to find something unjust. But we will be united in actually identifying something in our society as an injustice that we have to fight against, rather than saying, I don't really understand why this is unjust or why you want to do something about it, but I'm just going to delegate it to you because you're part of this group that I can't understand. So that's my substantiation. Are there some things that smart people in the academic tradition of standpoint epistemology will have said that are incompatible with that? Probably. But I think that this can accommodate enough of a tradition to be politically productive. And if there's elements that it can't accommodate, I think that's probably because they're wrongheaded. But perhaps you have an example that that squeezes me a little bit.
No, I don't think so. That's pretty persuasive what you just said. I mean, maybe to put the point more generally, so we can get on to the next kind of plank about what you're talking about here. I mean, to put it in maybe Charles Taylor's terms again, his essay on the politics of recognition. I mean, there's a tendency, I think, for liberalism to focus on universality and what we have in common, to build solidarity in your terms. But the worry, I think, is that in affirming or pursuing universality, we might overlook difference, that is, the recognition of a certain kind of difference, or what's normatively valuable about maintaining a society where there are distinct kind of identities and distinct viewpoints, and that there could be a homogenizing effect. Now, I don't think that that's the way the kind of discourse is developed. I'm wondering maybe if you think Taylor is more persuasive on these grounds, but I worry if there's a way in which, you know, the discussion is moving towards, we either have universality in liberalism or we have difference, and we can't combine we can't combine the two, or can we? I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I do think that some of Taylor's work and some of Flicker's work and the sort of liberal multiculturalist broadly, or I don't know exactly what label to give Taylor. I'm motivated by a very homogenizing mainstream culture of the 1960s and 70s and perhaps 80s, but now feels really quite out of date. I mean, I think we've moved past it for good reasons, but it really doesn't feel like that's where the center of a society is in the United States or Canada today. I've written about that a little bit in my last book, The Great Experiment, which is really asking the question of how we can make diverse democracies work in a way that's fair and allows them to thrive. And I have a chapter in which I talk about the kind of different models of integration, or the different models, I guess, of cultural life in a diverse society. And so, you know, one of those is one of the melting pot, right? That was traditionally the most influential in that post-war period, but identified. And that's, I think, what people like Taylor and Kimlicka are responding to and reacting to in certain kinds of ways. And by the way, the play The Melting Pot by Isaac Sangwala is really interesting and slightly gives the lie to the idea that people who championed The Melting Pot were ahistorical, that they didn't understand conflict. The play is about a very deep identitarian conflict between two of the protagonists. So I think there's sort of more sophistication in that tradition than is sometimes recognized. But I agree that the way in which The Melting Pot ended up being used socially was far too homogenizing in the kind of ways you outline. Now, I think that the kind of response to that of a salad bowl or of a mosaic, of this idea of a society in which you just have these different groups that are living in parallel, but are never really truly in communication with each other, is in certain important ways wrongheaded as well. And in part, it is wrongheaded because I think it's going to make it much harder to trust and political solidarity that we need in order to sustain a welfare state, or at the extreme, to avoid the forms of, you know, social fracture that can lead to violent conflict. And so what I propose in that context is a new model that is inspired by a public park, because what's attractive about a public park is that it allows people a choice between different modes of life. You know, you and I can go to a park together after this conversation, and we're so in the middle of this conversation we don't want to talk to anybody else and we're just among ourselves. Or we can go to the park and, you know, have a beer and start chatting with people who happen to be sitting next to us and make new friendship with people who may come from different walks of life and be situated in different groups in our society. And I think that's the right model, because in a liberal society and a diverse democracy, it is perfectly legitimate for some people to make the choice to stay among themselves, to have deep religious convictions, for example, or commitments that I want to prioritize in my life. And so most of my life is going to be spent with people who share the same religious convictions and so on. But we also need some of the people who are those bridge builders, right? If everybody does that, I think we start to have a problem of political stability. We need some people to go out there and make friendships and business relationships and perhaps romantic relationships across those kind of boundaries and divides. So I guess, you know, this is not in the new book, but that's how I think about this. And I think that sort of would be my most natural answer to the question about, you know, are there legitimate concerns about this overly homogenizing majority culture? And the answer is yes, even for that doesn't seem to me to be the sort of the tendency of our society right now.
All right. It sounds to me like, you know, the thrust of your research is that what Taylor said, that the worry is too much homogenization. Now the worry is too much fragmentation in American public life. Is that a way to overly simplify your, that we need actually more solidarity, more integration in order to succeed in the future?
Well, I mean, I would say we need the right kind, right? So it depends a little bit on the context. I do think in certain specific environments, what you're saying is right. So, you know, I think one thing that comes relatively naturally to us as humans is an identification with certain forms of subnational group, whether it's ethnic, religious, sometimes ideological groups. And I think we always want a healthy balance between those and some forms of more national cooperation in diverse democracies. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to recognize each other as general competitors, not going to be able to sustain a welfare state and so on. And we see in countries like Lebanon how troubling it becomes when sort of everything about your life is deeply determined by the particular group you're in. And so the question is always sort of, how do you keep that balance in a principled manner that is informed for me by the principles of philosophical liberalism? I do think in some areas I'm worried about that. It's perfectly fine for me for high schoolers of 15 or 16 to be members of cultural clubs, which are effectively chosen by race. That is part of a freedom of association, and teenagers at that age certainly should have significant agency. When we see, and this is something that actually does happen in a lot of elite private schools in the country today, teachers coming into groups when children are 6 or 7 or 8, and saying, I'm going to split you up into racially separated affinity groups. and you're going to the Black group over there, and you're going to the Latino group over there, and you're going to the Asian American group over there, I do start to be concerned. And I both start to be concerned because I think that that is trying, in the spirit of the sort of popularized understanding of strategic essentialism, to say in order to resist against these forms of injustice, we need to encourage you to have the right kind of racial identity. And Dalton School, for example, is very explicit about that in some of the materials explaining the practice on the website. But that you know, the educational consultants that shaped the curriculum would are saying, you know, our task, our goal is to get people to have the right kind of understanding of a racial group. I worry about that being the message that teachers are sending to people in elementary school. And I also, by the way, am concerned about a natural follow-up question, which is, well, what happens to the white kids? You know, when I was in school in Germany, I'm Jewish, there was Catholic or Protestant religion. When I had a kind of free period in which I just did nothing, and I hung out with two sort of kids of Turkish guest workers, and, you know, that was fine. But at scale, it sort of becomes a problem, because either you allow the white kids to do what we did, which is like, we just get to hang out and chew the shit, and that's very nice, but that doesn't exactly seem fair to the other kids who, you know, are doing less fun things while we get to go to the playground. But I worry that what's actually going to happen is, you know, an attempt for which I have sympathy to explain to the white kids why they enjoy certain forms of privilege, and why they should be concerned about certain aspects of what whites have done in the United States, or something like that. My problem is not that I'm offended by that. My problem is that, as somebody who's read some social science, including some group psychology, that's not how it's going to work out, because humans have a really powerful tendency to form groups and to favor the in-group over the out. And if you test at 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 and 11 and 15 and 17 and 25, that the most important thing about them is their racial identity. That fundamentally, above everything else, they are white or they're Latino or they're Black. Some white kids may then become anti-racist activists. But I think a lot of them are going to say, well, if that's my most fundamental identity, let me engage in the kinds of forms of group politics that are a natural concomitant of liberal democracy and fight for the interests of whites. And that doesn't strike me as a particularly promising or realistic recipe for how to build a better society. Now, again, the counter to that is not to say, you know, any form of ethnic identification in all contexts is terrible. I certainly... you know, my Jewish identity growing up in Germany was in good part based on the history of persecution of my family, even though I'm not religious. And certainly I think that in ways that Tommy Shelby and others have described, there can be forms of healthy, important Black solidarity in the United States, and the same perhaps for Latinos and Asian Americans and so on. But when it becomes the primary form of identity we have in our society, and it's encouraged by educational institutions, you know, from grade one, I do think that has a potential of misfiring in quite concerning ways.
Right, and the other thing you point out is ways in which there's a separation of these groups, but there's also kind of implicitly a prioritization of them. That is, there's no sort of effort to make groups equal. I mean, in the context in particular of, maybe we could turn to this, the identity-sensitive public policy. You have a lot of interesting things to say about that. For example, in the policy around COVID, the distribution of vaccines and treatments and so forth, there's, at least among some, an effort to distribute goods based on you know, the historical injustices that have gone to particular groups. So I was wondering, maybe you could speak to that particular topic on identity sensitive public policy, particularly the COVID example is a good one that you could draw on. But I was also hoping that you could say maybe a case that's maybe a bit more difficult. The affirmative action case just came down here in the Supreme Court a few months ago, which is, I guess, another example of identity-sensitive public policy that I think in the book you say you have a little bit more sympathy to. How do you think about that in the context of this particular chapter, that particular example?
Yeah, great. So, you know, during the pandemic, I actually sat through a meeting, it was virtual, of course, of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, which was the key committee which advised the CDC on how to structure prioritization for vaccines. And that recommendation was taken up with slight modifications at the end, and then adopted by not all, but most American states. And I have to say, it was one of the most shocking forms of political deliberation that I've witnessed in my life. I mean, there's an attempt, you know, it sort of, you know, was pretending to be a sort of political theory seminar in a way. But the ideas were so confused and I think so pernicious that they left me actually quite shaken. And you know, we can talk through that in a little bit of detail if you like. So just for context, you know, there were significant racial disparities in COVID. It's very clear that the age disparities were by far and away the strongest, right? That the sort of extent to which your risk increased with was empirically you know, the most powerful driver of fatalities. And so what we saw in virtually all countries that were faced with this you know, distributive justice in the early months of vaccine availability, of who do we prioritize, was a strongly age-based system. So most places gave some amount of priority to medical workers because you obviously don't want them to be sick and you don't want them to be infecting other patients that they're in contact with. But really, with very few exceptions and very limited exceptions, it was a very simple system of saying, you know, the above 80s first and the above 75s next and the above 70s next and so on and so forth. And that had the advantage of getting vaccines to the people who are most likely to have a life saved by them. And it also had important practical advantages, because it's quite easy to communicate to the wider public when you're eligible. And it is quite hard, it is also quite easy to deal with free riding attempts, which will always exist to some extent, and exist there perhaps to some extent as well. But when you're saying, look, the over 80s are eligible from today, that's easy to put in the headline. People understand who's over 80 and who isn't. And it's relatively easy to ascertain the age of people, right? This presentation to ACIP argued that following a similar method in the United States would save lives. So it acknowledged that on the empirical models made by the CDC, prioritizing the elderly would save thousands of lives. But then it argued that this would be immoral or unethical. And the reason why it said that would be the case was so-called equity, their understanding of equity. And so what they said is, well, unfortunately, older people in America are disproportionately white. And that effectively makes prioritizing older people a non-starter. And so therefore, we should prioritize essential workers. Now, you know, there is a normative argument for prioritizing people who have to be out in the world for their job, getting us, you know, food and keeping our systems running at the time of a pandemic, and I take that seriously. And there could have been an empirical argument that perhaps somehow that saves more lives because then they infect fewer people. But again, according to the CDC's own model, that was not going to be the case. It was going to increase the number of lives that are lost. And so there's this amazing presentation with sort of three different buckets, which you know, include things like practicality, in which it sort of, you know, basically claims that there's not much of a difference, even though I think it was unrealistic, etc. But then it comes down; it only has one bucket that's called ethics. And on ethics, this presentation gives 3 out of 3 points to prioritizing essential workers, and 1 out of 3 points to prioritizing the elderly, even though, according to the factual basis on which this presentation itself is drawing, it would lead predictably to thousands of more deaths in the United States. Now, I find that shocking. Let me tell you a couple of things about this. The first is that the impact of this was deeply screwed up. If you have any friends who are teaching at universities in the state of New York, I have many such friends, they all got the vaccine in January of 2021 because university teachers who were not in the classroom, who were teaching 100% virtually, were part of a group of essential workers who were prioritized. The second problem that ensued is that a far too large group of people then became eligible, in theory, at a time where in practice, people did not have enough vaccines. So I became eligible at the beginning of March in 2021 on the basis of being a faculty member at Johns Hopkins University. I looked at websites. It was very hard to get a vaccine appointment, but in the end, I was able to get one in a rural part of Maryland. I rented a car. I drove down there. I was completely within the rules, but I was able to get access to this vaccine because I had access to it, etc. A lot of people who are actually more at danger and who are more at risk, including a lot of elderly people who are non-white, were not able to do that. So my impression of this policy is, and there's some strong empirical evidence for it, it involves some element of conjecture, but my strong impression of it is that not only did it increase the number of deaths because of the pandemic in the United States, I assume that it increased the number of African-Americans who died, the number of Latinos who died, because of a very simple logic that giving two 25-year-old Uber drivers a vaccine, but denying it to a 75-year-old retiree may increase equity in the sense of how many non-white people access the vaccine at which point, but it is going to increase overall fatalities among African Americans. So look, there's public policy screw-ups, and this is a particularly bad one. I don't want to say that this is representative of a whole of a tradition. The fact that this became policy of a public health authorities in the United States in the last 2 years with explicit reference to the ideas, to the identity synthesis, because we haven't had enough of a serious public debate and a serious philosophical critique of some of the ways in which these ideas can go wrong, is not, I think, a coincidence.
That's great. You want to say anything about affirmative action?
Yeah,
that'd be a lengthy discussion, I'm sure, but
I'm sure it will be.
It seems to me that you're more friendly to that, right? I mean, based on your chapter. It seems to me this is of the same type, but that is a public policy that's sensitive to racial injustices and is, in part bolstered by the identity synthesis. It's not it's certainly not a popular policy if you look at polls, but what do you think?
Yeah, let me make a sort of metamethodological point and then a more specific point. So the metamethodological point is that I think like many other political and legal theorists who didn't grow up in the United States, sort of quite skeptical of a way in which we often conflate moral questions with constitutional questions in the United States, right? I don't think that the right way to think through the moral standing of a death penalty is by, debating whether or not it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, it's a really weird way to puzzle through that question. And I don't think that, even the question of abortion is best debated through whether or not there's a right to privacy, et cetera. So I'm in general quite skeptical of these forms of a constitutionalized discourse in the United States. I think it sort of draws our attention to those kind of mid-level moral questions and interpretive questions rather than other practical questions about how this is going to play out in a way that improves or deteriorates lives, or the deeper philosophical issues that are actually at stake. I think that mid-range is often quite misleading. I think, interestingly, the jurisprudence on affirmative action is a notable positive exception. I think that when you look at what the Supreme Court, at the basic normative criteria that the Supreme Court has used in order to judge the question of affirmative action, it's actually been a helpful set of standards that was shared by proponents of affirmative action, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg's, and by opponents like Antonin Scalia. And broadly speaking, they say, that there's both a kind of normative injury and a practical concern about the state giving benefits or denying benefits to its citizens on the basis of their racial identity. That in general, in keeping with the 14th Amendment, we should be very skeptical about the state invoking, which race you are part of in order to determine whether you're eligible for some kind of benefit. But they also recognize that there are certain specific circumstances in which there might be exceptions to that. There has to be a form of compelling state interest that is at stake, and the remedy has to be narrowly tailored such that there's no other non-race-based way that we can pursue that compelling state interest. And all of the jurisprudential debate over this question basically has come down to, how compelling is the state interest here and how narrowly tailored is the remedy. And, more progressive members of the Supreme Court like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg, would have said, this and that admissions policy passes that test, and conservative justices like the ones who are now in the majority and who passed down this new ruling will say, this or that admissions policy does not pass it. So the first thing I want to say is, uncharacteristically for me, I think that's a helpful way of thinking through that question, right? And so let me get a little bit more specific. Given the history of the United States, given the deep injustices in specifically against African Americans, I think that it would be deeply troubling to have elite campuses which train future leaders of our society be nearly exclusively white, or to have a hugely underproportionally share of African Americans in particular, right? And so I have a lot of sympathy for the political project or the pedagogical project or whatever you want to call it, of universities saying, well, let's take action as a kind of euphemism, but let's take affirmative steps. Let's try and figure out initiatives that'll make sure that that ceases to be the case. I certainly understand the motivation behind that. I'm very sympathetic to it. I do at the same time have concerns about the way in which that has played out in the United States. One of the concerns is that I do think that we're discriminating against Asian Americans, not just on behalf of African Americans, and in fact, not particularly on behalf of African Americans, but also on behalf of whites. And so some of the data that came out about Harvard in this lawsuit is deeply troubling to me, right? I mean, when you have Asian Americans outcompeting other groups on academic performance, when you see that alumni interviews, which you might assume are slightly skewed against Asian Americans because alumni are rarely Asian because of the timing and so on of what the student body looked like 20 or 30 years ago and might have certain kinds of prejudices, give the same personality score on average to Asian American applicants as to white applicants. When even the objective measures we have of extracurricular performance, being president of this or that high school club and whatever else, put Asian Americans roughly on par with whites. And then you get to the personality score that admissions officers that have never met these people in person give to Asian Americans. And their standards of deviation lower than for any other racial group. So that Harvard's not quite explicit, but implicit and effective defense of why it is so much harder to get into the College of the Asian American is, it just so happens that the average Asian American has really shitty personality. I find that to be normatively very troubling. So that's one point I want to make. The other point I want to make is that I would much rather be operating here within the framework of some form of explicit reparations or rectificatory justice than the very squishy term of diversity, which I think misleads us in important ways. Many of my best students of any race are children and grandchildren of recent Nigerian or Kenyan immigrants. But sort of the idea that the right response to slavery in the United States is to prioritize the kids of recent immigrants from those countries who now constitute up to 50% of the black students at Ivy League universities. That's weird. The idea that a friend of mine who grew up in Spain and then the parents moved to Mexico for business and they grew up partially in that context, and then the family came to the United States, that they should receive benefits as Latinos within our system of affirmative action, that is straightforwardly absurd. And so I think the way in which this has been operationalized, often goes wrong. And then I have a third concern, which was, underlined by recent data from the New York Times about all the other forms of privilege that go with, quote unquote, holistic admissions in the United States, which give a huge boost to the top 1% and the top 0.1%. And that is in part because of donations and preferences for legacy students, and by the way, preferences for the children of faculty, which we should also interrogate very critically. But it is also because of, athletic admissions and the overall idea that sort of what we should be doing is to read these essays in which people bare their soul and tell us about the great injustices that have happened to them, and these enlightened admissions officers are going to be able to actually judge what of that is true and sort of prioritize the students who had the hardest life. I mean, the ability to craft an essay like that co-varies with access, with money, with socioeconomic status, with Bourdieuan habitus, vastly more than we recognize. And so I do also have concerns about how the overall system sort of claims to be in the service of creating these ethnically diverse classes, but actually gives huge amounts of privilege to the rich and to other privileged people in our society in all kinds of ways. So I sort of, look, my personal feeling, if I'm being completely honest, is just burn the whole system down. And there's not affirmative entire way in which America does college admissions. Burn down the college essay. Burn down having to be club of your high school, president of your high school club. Burn down athletic admissions. Burn down the preference for children of faculty members. And then the new system, yes, I think it's important to make sure that, Harvard doesn't become a college in which most students are white, or in which there's very few black students. And I think we need to find ways to ensure that generally underprivileged students socioeconomically and in other ways actually have access to those schools. But perhaps the start to that is not to try and rejigger the system as best we can after this ruling, but to actually make a fresh start.
Yeah, good. We didn't have a chance to get to talk about cultural appropriation or freedom of speech concerns and the so-called cancel culture, that these are important parts of your discussion. I just wanted to conclude, because we're running a little long, and just ask you in general. I mean, you conclude the book with a defense of liberalism. And I was wondering if you'd say a little bit about, you have a chapter on how people can argue against the identity synthesis, as you admit. I mean, this is something of a difficult thing to do, because people might be reasonably worried about, if not losing their jobs, losing their friends, and so forth, if you say the wrong thing in polite company. So what's in general your advice for, how to make a case, how to make the best case for liberalism, and how to challenge the identity synthesis?
Let me just rudely abuse my guest's privileges, because I do want to hit on one other thing that I think is particularly interesting.
It's perfectly fine. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think I don't know that I'm going to get much opportunity to talk about it in other contexts. But that is sort of the third part of my book, which really is trying to reconstruct what I think the identity synthesis is, and to explain the right and the smart liberal response to it. So one of the things I was struck by in reading the smarter parts, the serious parts of the identity synthesis, is the extent to which it was explicitly designed and directed against liberalism. In fact, Richard Delgado, the author of Critical Race Theory and Introduction, a very influential text at undergraduate level, writes explicitly, you know, we were always just like focused on attacking liberals and pointing out what's wrong with them. And now that, you know, like suddenly like conservatives have a little bit of ascendancy in our society, you know, some parts of the tradition are starting to ask questions of conservatives as well. And I think that's an important piece of background here, that really a lot of this tradition was always designed as a critique of liberalism above everything else. That is the one interesting point of connection to Marxism, by the way. In that respect, it's similar to Marxism, that always in some ways was more critical of liberal democracy and more directed against liberal democracy than against some other ideological competitors. And so, you know, when I set out towards the end of the book of providing a kind of rational reconstruction of the identity synthesis, I think that comes out quite clearly. And to me, you can sort of reconstruct this, you know, broad set of themes and ideas and so on in the identity synthesis around three primary claims. The first of these claims, and I'm actually going to, this is going to be the one part where I want to read, because I've formulated these carefully, and for this order, I want to make sure that I put them carefully. So the first key claim of the identity synthesis, I think, is that the key to understanding the world is to examine it through the prism of group identities like race, gender, and sexual orientation. So there's kind of an epistemological claim here that to understand what's going on in the world, we really have to base that on these fundamental questions of identity. But they're not just an important lens, but they're the fundamental lens. And you see that even in the way it gets popularized, right? Where sort of, you know, in the past, my dear Marxist grandparents would have looked at any kind of social situation and said, oh, you know, you think this is about X, Y, and Z. Really, it's about class relations, right? And you see a lot of that today when, you know, oh, you know, there's this kind of conflict where it doesn't seem to be about race, but really it's about race. It is, you know, in that sense, a privileging of that prism to understand the world over others. The second part of a supposedly universal values and neutral rules merely serve to obscure the ways in which privileged groups dominate those that are marginalized. So the claim here is not just that liberal societies often fail to live up to their ideals, a claim that is obviously true when you look at the beautiful United States Constitution and the rather less beautiful social reality of the country for many centuries, including slavery and Jim Crow and so on. But it is that really this principle sort of trying to pull the wool over your eyes in a certain kind of way. It is a active agent of false consciousness that is trying to obscure the actual power operation in our society. And so therefore, the third claim of the rational reconstruction is that to build a just world, we must adopt norms and laws that explicitly make the way the state treats each citizen, and how citizens treat each other depend on the identity groups to which they belong. So rather than trying to live up to our universal norms and neutral rules, rather than trying to make sure that the way in which you actually are treated in our society doesn't depend on race and so on, rather than to ensure that the forms of discrimination that persist are ended, what you should do is to give up on that and structure a society in which explicitly the way you're treated is in many contexts often dependent on the group of which you're a part. And so I have a whole case for liberalism that hopefully is more lyrical, but I just want to give a liberal response to each of these claims, and I'm not going to read those. So the first is that, yes, of course, important things about our society turn on identity questions like race and sex and sexual orientation and gender and other things. And of course, we must be aware of that. But we should avoid a monomaniacal view of the world that only sees the world through one prism. Marxists were wrong to only think about class. Members of the identity synthesis are wrong to only think about or predominantly think about those forms of identity. To understand a particular situation, we have to be methodologically open to different and competing claims, including those of class, of race, and so on, as well as other kinds of ways to understand the world. So we've learned, perhaps by engaging with tradition, some of the ways in which these things are important, but to privilege over other prisms is a mistake. The second point is to acknowledge that, yes, of course, in practice, universal values and neutral rules have often been fig leaves for injustice. We often have failed to live up to these values. But actually, they have allowed us to make tremendous political progress. One of the ways in which America has become a more just society over the course of the last centuries is people from Frederick Douglass to Martin Luther King to Barack Obama to others saying, how can you promise this and then treat people in that way, right? It's the insistence that MLK had to cash the check that was written out in the United States Constitution. So liberalism is not just forced consciousness. It is a powerful set of aspirations that give the oppressed the tools, some of the tools they need in order to fight for equal treatment. By the way, free speech is a very important part of that, since we didn't touch on that in that part of the conversation. And so therefore, the thing we should do, broadly speaking, is not to give up on the aspiration of building a more just society in which how you're going to be treated is most of the time going to become less dependent on the group you're from. It is to remedy the injustices to such an extent that what group you're a part of becomes less salient in those kinds of contexts, because it structures less of our social relations, it structures less of the injustice. We should live up to, not give up on, the basic ideals of philosophical liberalism. So with that very long prelude, let me answer the actual question you asked. At least I'm explicit about answering another question first, and say this. There's all kinds of practical advice I have on how to formulate these values. And I think it's particularly hard for people who are perhaps less educated and less sophisticated, who are more afraid that they don't quite know how to talk about things, and they might say the wrong word and so on. I think those concerns are less alive for this audience, because it's a sophisticated audience of people who think seriously about political theory, and you know, for many of whom it's your profession to use words. And so there, I would say just have the courage to do that, and have the courage to speak up for your values in a way that's not from a defensive crouch. I think too often we're in this frame of not too farism that I mentioned at the beginning, where you sort of feel like, well, I'm arguing with people who sort of want to do the right thing, but they're going a little too far, and that puts me in this sort of awkward position of how do I formulate that? Look, for me, I believe what I believe because I fought hard about it and come to that conclusion. I may be wrong about it, but I'm proud of what I believe. I'm fighting for a more just society. I'm a proud anti-racist, by the way. I don't always like how some people like Ibram Kendi interpret that term, but I certainly lay claim to a proud tradition of anti-racism that I'm a part of. And so I'm not going to argue from defensive crouch. I'm going to take these questions seriously and think about them carefully and express myself with consideration. But I shouldn't be ashamed of what I think, because I want to build what I think is going to be a more fair and a more just and a more thriving society. And so I think just having that self-confidence in how you argue, and then extending grace to people who disagree with you, and knowing what you might be able to persuade them and all of those things, that is the key. The most important thing is to get out of this position where you're sort of nearly apologetic for what you're going to say before you say it, and that makes it easy for others to say that you somehow have wrong intentions or bad motives, because you yourself seem to half believe that. If you're a philosophical liberal who's very aware of the deep dangers on the right, but who also thinks that some of these developments we've talked about on the left are misguided, argue for it carefully and thoughtfully, and you'll be fine.
Well, this has been a very enjoyable conversation, Yasha. I really appreciate you joining me on the Political Theory Review.
I really enjoyed this. Thank you, Jeff.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review.
Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.